Welcome to the first live recording of The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality. And now, I'd like to introduce your master of ceremonies for this special episode, Todd Robbins!
Oh, thank you, thank you, thank you. Thank you, Carol, I appreciate that. Thank you. And welcome, everyone. I've been called upon to host this and be your master of ceremonies because I'm a New York guide here, and I'm here to welcome these folks to our hood here. And it is so great. The reason I was asked this is because I am the executive director of Coney Island USA. We're the not-for-profit organization out in Coney Island that's been trying to keep Coney Island alive for the last 3 decades. And we're fighting the good fight out there. And so we hope you all come out and visit us and see the sideshow and the burlesque show. I hope you came out to see the mermaid parade and all the other stuff that we do there. If you want more information about us, you just go to ConeyIsland.com. And so since I'm kind of a Brooklyn guy, it's appropriate that we welcome the Skeptic's Guide to Brooklyn here. For those that are listening on the web and don't know exactly, well, there's been quite a bit about Brooklyn in the press this last week, because for the first time ever, a tornado tore through Brooklyn, and scientists and researchers and meteorologists are trying to figure out how the hell that happened and why. And I think the explanation is pretty simple. It's the gods are pissed that the Skeptical Guide to the Universe is coming to Brooklyn. I would not be a bit surprised that after the podcast today, if we walk outside, the East River is running red and there are frogs falling from the sky. Because we are here, as I mentioned before we started here, we are here in the shadow of the Watchtower building of the Jehovah's Witness that's right behind us. And we're nestled between the Brooklyn and Manhattan Bridge here, both in the crosshairs of Al-Qaeda. So sit back, relax, folks. We're doomed, but we're going to have a fun time. So instead of just introducing our panel today, the folks of the show, I thought I'd do it sort of Coney Island style and do what's known as a bally. And the bally is that little sales pitch that's done out in front of the sideshow. And I've done these thousands of times. So I've kind of written up a few notes on these folks and introduced them the way we kind of sell the show out in Coney Island. So this is the way we're going to do it, ladies and gentlemen. I say, this is it. This is the one you read about. You heard about it. Now you got to see it live. It is the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. It's all real. It's all live. It's all on the inside. It is truly amazing, amusing, confounding, and confusing what you're going to experience here. It is wild, wonderful, and one of a kind. You are going to truly experience the strange, the unusual, the bizarre, and I dare say, the beautiful. Who are you going to meet on the inside? Well, you're going to meet Evan, the teddy bear Bernstein, the nicest man in the universe, ladies and gentlemen. Here he is. Why? He is so sweet. He is so agreeable. He doesn't have a bad word to say about anyone except Sylvia Brown and Uri Geller and James Van Prague and thousands of others. That's Evan, the teddy bear Bernstein, right over there. You're about to meet on the inside, yes, the skeptic herself. I'm talking about Rebecca Watson. Yes, sirree, sir. She is that femme fatale of the Mensa mob. Now, you spend some time with her, and not only will you feel your IQ rising, but your blood pressure as well. And I think you know what I'm talking about, guys. That's Rebecca Watson. Yeah, let's hear it for her. You are also going to experience on the inside, my friends, the death-defying deeds of the flying novellas. Yes, this is a triumphant trio of high-flying free thinkers. Starting off, we've got Robert Bob Novella. He is the nano freak. Yes, he is the nano freak. Because to him, size does matter. That's the nano-freak, Bob Novella. You're also going to meet the Sultan of Satire himself, Jay Novella. Step right up, my boy. He will make you laugh. He'll make you think. He'll make you think you're laughing. That's the Sultan of Satire himself. And, of course, the ringleader of this rogues gallery of rational reasoning people, I'll tell you, is the one and only Stephen the Brain Novella. Let's hear it for him. Oh, mercy. What What a smart man he is. He's so bright, his papa calls him Sonny. That's how bright he is. You will be amazed to see how much intelligence is crammed in his cranium there. Why, he's a genius. No, super genius. That is Stephen Novell. Now, folks, the show's about to start on the inside, so get your ticket and go now. Like I say, it's wild, wonderful, one of a kind. It's the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Let's go now. Take it away, Stephen, if you would. Thank you.
Thank you, Todd. Todd, that was great. It really is a great pleasure to have you here. I think you captured the essence of the Skeptic's Guide quite well with that introduction.
I do what I can.
And there's a lot of other people I want to thank as well. First, thanks all of you for coming here. It's great to see a crowd like this. We're all very happy you came. I know some of you traveled quite far. Especially want to thank Mike from Skeptic's Guide fans.net. So Mike has, on his own time, taken upon his own initiative to set up the SGUfans.net. Why don't you tell us a little bit about it? I'm sure a lot of people here already know about it, but just give us the quick summary.
Yeah, well, it's basically that's what it is. It's a Skeptic's Guide fan site. What I do is I go through all your episodes, or at first I did. I went through all your episodes and sort of listed all your funny quotes and everything. It was an idea that started on the forums. That's how that started, and now what I do is every time you release an episode, I gather some interesting facts and funny quotes and try to get some sound bites out of there so people can download and see how funny you guys are.
Well, thanks, Mike. We really appreciate it. Thanks for coming, too. It's funny, you know, we read the Mike's summaries of our own shows ourselves, and sometimes reading the quotes that he pulls out, I'm like, damn, we're funny. I mean, who would have figured? I mean, it's almost shocking to us. It sounds a lot funnier when you read it out of context like that when he pulls it on the website. But again, thanks a lot. Also want to thank James Randi, who is affiliated with the Skeptic's Guide, and he is contributing the Randi Speaks to our show every month. We got him back. He was after a technical hiatus both last week and this week, and hopefully we'll have him in perpetuity. There's a lot of people to thank as well. I mean, a lot goes into making the show. Of course, I have to thank, you know, all of my skeptical rogues. Thank Perry DeAngelis, who can't be here tonight. He really regrets that he couldn't be here today to do the show. We miss you, Perry. Wish you were here. I'd like to also thank John Huntington for helping set up the venue and for donating his time, and those of some of the students who are here today as well, helping us out today. So thanks a lot, John. And there's a lot of unseen people, the people sort of that are behind the scenes that allow the show to happen. I have to thank my wife, Jocelyn, who's sitting here in the front row. Thanks, Jocelyn. And, you know, we all have, you know, significant others who, you know, put up with the late nights. And so we couldn't do what we do if we didn't have people behind us supporting us. So just, you know, we wanted to thank everybody as well. So just to get us started, we are going to do, the bulk of the show is going to be a question and answer session. Since we have a live audience, this is an opportunity to take live questions, unscripted. We have no idea what you're going to ask us. So now you get to see how much we really know when we don't get to read the answers ahead of time. But I wanted to just talk for 5 to 10 minutes about why I do this, why we do this, what the Skeptic's Guide has meant to us, and what skepticism means to us. You know, definitely, I know for me personally, and also for the others from talking with them, that there's just a part of us that likes to share our knowledge with other people, share our thoughts, and just there's an intellectual conversation that goes on, just makes life more interesting. And more fun to live. You know, I'm an academic neurologist. I chose to go into academics and slash my potential earnings, you know, significantly. More because I love teaching. I do some research, but really the teaching is the bulk of my academic activity. And that's because seeing patients, being a practicing clinical neurologist is fun, but teaching how to do it is 10 times as much fun for me. And not only that, but I found that, you know, medical students are a very interesting body of people to teach because they have a few features that make them very fun to teach. They really appreciate knowledge for knowledge's sake. They really appreciate the knowledge that I'm giving them. They intimately see its value for them, and they greatly appreciate it. And I feel there's a lot of similarity between them and skeptics, because skeptics appreciate knowledge and wisdom for its own sake. I think skeptics generally see the role that it plays in their own life. It's a practical set of knowledge that we're talking about usually. And they're also extremely appreciative of the time and the effort that we put in. And again, that makes what we do all the more rewarding. We often wonder to each other, to ourselves, would we still be doing this 2.5 years out if we still had like 200 listeners? It's a really hard question to answer, to know where we would be mentally if the audience of the show hasn't been growing as steadily as it has. But I think it would be hard to give up, even if we didn't have the success in terms of just raw numbers, because there's just something that's so intellectually vibrant about doing the show like this. But part of that is meeting people like you, getting the emails. We love to get the emails. We read every single one. We often discuss them with each other. Some people email us just to tell us what a difference that we made in their lives. It does represent, there are some people who, not only just for them, this is not just a distraction while they're jogging, but also a lot of people have said, you know what, you guys are a beacon of light in my world, that I didn't know that I was a skeptic, or I knew I was a skeptic, but I didn't know that there were other skeptics out there. And we introduced them to the fact that there is a community of skeptics. And I think that that's, you know, a very important thing, and we're very happy to play that role, to be, in reality, one of the biggest venues in the world for organized skepticism. You know, we have, again, over 23,000 listeners, 50,000 downloads a week. That's as big as anything out there in the skeptical world. And again, the reason why we do that is because, you know, we like to not only teach, but not just teaching facts. I mean, teaching facts is important. And helpful. You have to know stuff. It's kind of hard to think about things if you don't have the facts to anchor them. But naked facts are a little dry and boring. What we talk about on the show is not just, here's a news item, this is what happened, but how should we think about it? And that's what's fun. That's what I found fun. Even when I tell medical students, I'm not going to teach you the facts that you could learn in a book or that you could learn from reading a journal article. You're going to read that on your own. You're going to learn the facts on your own time. When you're with me, I'm going to teach you how to think like a clinician, how to think like a doctor. And that's a lot harder to do, and it's a lot more fun, a lot more interesting. And what we try to do on the show is not just to tell you what to think or what the answer is, but how to think about things, to give the tools of skepticism, what we call the skeptic's toolbox, right? That's why we have segments like Name That Logical Fallacy. It's all about how to think in a way that leads you to conclusions which are more likely to be correct than just, you know, following your gut instinct or the vagaries of neurological function that we happen to evolve, right? We're trying to transcend a little bit beyond that and organize our thinking in such a way that we can approach interesting, emotionally charged, complex topics and have some way of navigating through that. The subject matter we choose, I think, is very fun. Often, it may seem very frivolous, like why do we have to talk about ideas or claims that are really so bizarre and ridiculous? You know, I remember when I was in college in Baltimore, sometimes I would spend a half an hour or 2 or 3 hours on my stoop arguing with some creationist who decided that my door would be a good one to knock on. And the purpose of that was, obviously, I wasn't going to convince them. And, you know, sometimes Jocelyn, who wasn't my wife at the time, but who would become my wife, or my other friends, why do you bother? Why do you spend 3 hours talking to that person? They're a nut job. You're never going to convince them. It's like, yeah, you know, but what I'm doing is I'm figuring out how to think about what they're saying and how to wrap my mind around. It's like find the logical fallacy in what they're saying. You know, it's a fun game to play. And again, we play that game on the Skeptic's Guide. And I think it actually does help give people the skeptical tools so that they could think and come to the conclusions for themselves. And that's, I guess, one of the central themes to our show is even though we try to speak authoritatively as we can about topics by looking up the information, we actually tell our audience, don't believe us. We don't want you to take anything that we say on our own authority. We want you to challenge us, to correct us when we make mistakes, which happens occasionally, you know. Every now and then, a factual error might creep into our show, and we're happy to correct it. But also, it's again, that makes it more of a conversation, which is another reason why we were so excited about doing a live show. So without further ado, I want to go on to the next segment of the show. We have a special guest with us today. In addition to Todd, who's going to be emceeing the show, we got a substitute guest panelist for our show today, Steve Mirsky from Scientific American. Steve is a senior editor of Scientific American, and who for a long time has done the anti-gravity column, which you'll find usually in the back of the magazine.
Moved to the opinion section.
You did? Okay, thanks. And also now hosts the Scientific American podcast. So, Steve, thanks for joining us.
Hi. Thank you. I'm recording also in case I say anything good. Just in terms of who came the furthest or farthest, I'm not sure. I need a copy editor for that. I think I must have come the farthest. I came from the Bronx. So I just wanted to share with you a little example of what we go through at Scientific American pretty much on a constant basis whenever we wake up in the morning, whenever we write about evolution, whenever we deal with intelligent design or straight-out creationism, and increasingly on other fronts, cosmology, geology, and we get mail from people who you wouldn't expect to be reading Scientific American, but they are. So I'm going to just take a moment and share this column I did from the June 2007 issue. This is called Dumb Cup, Recipe for a Steaming Cup of Something. On a chilly late March day, I was happily sipping a Starbucks half-calf when I caught a glimpse of a friend's cup and narrowly avoided performing a Danny Thomas-style spit take. On the side of the paper cup was printed, the way I see it, number 224, Darwinism's impact on traditional social values has not been as benign as its advocates would like us to believe. Despite the efforts of its modern defenders to distance themselves from its baleful social consequences, Darwinism's connection with eugenics, abortion, and racism is a matter of historical record, and the record is not pretty, end quote. And that was penned by Dr. Jonathan Wells, biologist and author of The Politically Incorrect Guide to Darwinism and Intelligent Design, which I highly recommend you not purchase, but pick up at the library, because it is a riot. Anyway, Dr. Wells is affiliated with the Discovery Institute in Seattle, and going after Dr. Wells, we do that all the time, so I thought I would use my column space to go after Starbucks, actually. So I'll just keep reading. I knew that Starbucks roasted the hell out of their beans, but I didn't realize they published half-baked ideas. A visit to the Starbucks website turned up an explanation. From the website, quote, "To get people talking, the way I see it is a collection of thoughts, opinions, and expressions provided by notable figures that now appear on our widely shared cups," end quote. Further, the cups are supposed to extend, quote, "the coffee house culture, a way to promote open, respectful conversation among a wide variety of individuals," end quote. Fair enough, this is me again, although an open, respectful conversation initiated by a closed, disrespectful assertion is going to be a challenge, especially without any context. To find some context, see among myriad sources Ernst Mayr's essay, Darwin's Influence on Modern Thought, July 2000, Scientific American, which I edited, and Michael Shermer's 2006 book, Why Darwin Matters. Nevertheless, I'd like to suggest some other quotes for Starbucks cups in the hopes that they too may stimulate piping hot conversations. The way I see it, number E to the I pi plus one, quote, "the ratio of the diameter and circumference is as 5/4 to 4, end quote. Indiana House Bill number 246, which would have legally declared the value of pi to be 3.2 in 1897. The way I see it, number 20, quote, "would you drink a quarter pounder with cheese? If you order a venti Starbucks cafe mocha, you might as well be sipping that 500-calorie burger through a straw. And a venti Starbucks java chip frappuccino with 650 calories and nearly a day's saturated fat is a McDonald's coffee plus 11 creamers and 29 packets of sugar," end quote. That's from the Center for Science in the Public Interest, September 5th, 2006. The way I see it, number 34, proof. Quote, "I'll quit coffee. It won't be easy drinking my Bailey straight, but I'll get used to it. It'll still be the best part of waking up," end quote. That's a Karen Walker from the TV show Will and Grace. The way I see it, number 1962. "Mr. Kroger, 2 C's, 2 D's, and an F. That's a 1.2 grade average. Congratulations, Kroger. You're at the top of the Delta Pledge class," end quote. Dean Vernon Wormer, of course. And we'll get back to Animal House momentarily. And finally, the way I see it, number 2, T-O-O. quote, popular palatable views of the world and how it came to be do not constitute science or truth, but decent science education requires that we share the truth we find, whether or not we like it, end quote. And that's Lynn Margulis, Distinguished Professor, University of Massachusetts, Amherst. I was really surprised not to hear from Jonathan Wells, actually, and I left explicit instructions to the people who field the letters at the magazine that if we got mail from Wells, we could not publish it. We could publish excerpts from it in a response from me, but we couldn't publish his mail in the magazine directly because he would then say that he has been published in Scientific American. Because that is the way those people work, right? Anyway, we got this one letter from a new subscriber who writes, "All I can say is, wow. I was looking forward to my new subscription to Scientific American. Little did I realize that scientifically minded must mean repudiating and ridiculing all aspects of faith. In my first issue, I read Mirsky's Dumb Cup editorial piece and found it quite defensive, resorting to ridicule instead of intelligent discussion." So I wrote back a few days ago. "Dear Mr. X, many thanks for taking the time to write with your concerns, but I must confess to some confusion about your reaction to my column about the intelligent design proponents' attack on Darwin featured on Starbucks cups. The ID proponents themselves constantly remind us that they are engaging in a strictly scientific argument. Therefore, how can my response to them, snarky and defensive though it may be regarded as an attack on faith?" Do you like that? Yeah, you like that. "On the other hand," I continued, "if you have discerned that the ID proponents are in fact arguing from a religious standpoint, don't they deserve to be run out of science discussions on a rail for their intellectually bankrupt and underhanded methodology? And wouldn't a certain defensive attitude be justified on the grounds that I am attempting to defend both science and my beloved United States of America? Gentlemen." I followed that, I BCC'd that email to some of the higher ups at Scientific American, and I followed it up with an email to them saying, "I predict that within a few moments we will be getting a subscription cancellation order from this guy." And the great thing about working at Scientific American, and by the way, I have not heard back from this gentleman, but the great thing about it is, about being at Scientific American, is that I got email back from the higher-ups congratulating me on the response. So I got to figure it's one of the few places in the world where you can be congratulating for actually losing business, because we really do believe in what we're doing there. So I just wanted to share that little taste of what it's like to field these kinds of ideas out into the world, and you inevitably get angry responses like this, and it's just a constant source of amusement, amazement, and some depression, but more amusement than depression, actually. Thanks.
Thank you, Steve. That was wonderful. And I gotta say, I always find discussions of anti-gravity uplifting. Hey, it's just like comedy. So, moving right along, we're going to segue right into the Q&A, because you've got these people here. They're in the light there. They've got large red targets kind of all over them there. If there's anything you would like to ask, we request that you step right down here, speak into the mic so it can be recorded, and ask your question. So, who has a question? I know someone must have. Come, step forward. Be brave. Be bold. Welcome. Just say your name and go ahead.
It's kind of cheating because I'm standing, sitting next to the microphone. Rod Clark from California. Steve, you and I had corresponded briefly before about hyperbaric oxygen therapy and for autism, and your response to me was that it's crap, which I knew, but I wanted just a second opinion. So I passed that information along to my friend whose daughter unfortunately has autism, but they're trying like every credulous sort of crazy therapy you can think of. I started looking into the organizations that are the support organizations, like TACA Now and Defeat Autism Now, and they all seem to support this BS. Do you have any idea why that is? And is there any real, honest autism support organizations out there for these people?
Yeah, you know, a lot of the patient grassroots support groups for specific diseases, they're extremely variable in terms of their scientific quality. Most of them are started by patients and families with a disease, and therefore they're not scientific in their organization. They're meant to provide services or help provide services for patients with a specific disease like autism. It's meant to lobby for research and for laws that are necessary or favorable for people, you know, with special needs, and also to provide, you know, services. So you have people who mean well, who have often can marshal a lot of resources. They have tremendous energy and enthusiasm, but they don't necessarily have a scientific background. Now, sometimes those groups develop a very cooperative relationship with scientists who are actually doing research in that field, and then that becomes a very productive relationship, although you still have to monitor it very carefully. I've seen that even the best meaning groups actually hamper the progress of science by trying to exert too much external control by the money that they raise. Inadvertently, you could do this very easily. But then there are other groups who develop a hostile relationship to scientists because their scientists aren't telling them what they want to hear. And that is, the autism world is dominated by, unfortunately, that relationship. There are still a couple of groups that are better. It's hard for me to remember off the top of my head which are the ones that are better. I know there's a blog, the Autism Diva, which is a very good site to go to for information. There's the neurodiversity movement, which is a mixed bag. They reject all, you know, I should say most of the autism pseudoscience, except for the concept of neurodiversity itself, which is that autism is not a problem. It's just another way of being. You know, and I disagree with that philosophy. But other than that, they're actually very pro-science, and they're very anti-pseudoscience within the autism world.
Yeah, Steve, how would they feel about a treatment then, if it's normal?
Treatment, well, that's the thing. They often think that they're against a lot of the pseudoscientific treatments because they're against treatment, you know, sometimes just philosophically, because you don't treat people for being outgoing and you don't treat them for being autistic. It's just another kind of personality that people have. That's the extreme end of that belief. But it's hard in a desperate disease where there aren't any cures and it has a dramatic effect on the quality of life, like autism. It's very understandable that families and patients are desperate for a treatment. And people do take that attitude, you know, why not? Why not try everything? And scientists are often put in the role of saying, no, you shouldn't try that because that is not a valid treatment and it doesn't work. And people often do not like being told that. Because they're sort of stuck in this mindset of it couldn't hurt. But actually, treatments that have no plausibility can hurt. You can actually hurt people. There are kids who were killed from chelation therapy for autism. The autism has zero, I mean, the chelation therapy has zero potential to cure them or to help them, but they it's a very risky therapy. Chelation therapy is, you know, giving, you know, actual, you know, drugs, IV drugs, in order to leach out heavy metals from the blood because they think that autism is due to heavy metal toxicity. So the theory is wrong. The treatment is the wrong treatment. It's actually a risky treatment. It can cause harm and in some cases even death. So that's an obvious example where there's direct actual physical harm from the treatment. So there has to be some method to decide what treatments are more likely to help than they are to hurt. And again, there are some groups that are scientific. There are others that are more emotionally based and haven't, you know, had that cooperative relationship with science. And they can be very, very counterproductive. Autism is probably the worst example of that now. And they actually, the grassroots autism movements take it one step beyond just promoting pseudoscience. They act, and their hostile relationship with scientists, they are actually have a conspiracy theory about the scientific community, and they think there's a conspiracy among scientists and the FDA and the medical community and pediatricians, you know, and big pharma in order to actually hide the real cause of autism and to keep the cures from people. It doesn't get more hostile than that when you think that these are really evil people who are creating this real incredible malfeasance of condemning millions of people to autism when they know what the cause is and they know what the treatments are, but they're refusing to do it in order to line their buddies' pockets in big pharma. I mean, it's really a very bizarre, incredibly paranoid conspiracy theory. And it has gotten to the point where there is actual physical hostility towards scientists whose research produces results which they don't like. And to that has now become an issue, where individual scientists do everything they can to steer clear of moms against mercury and autism now, a lot of these groups, because they're actually have gone beyond being verbally hostile to actually being physically hostile and threatening the lives of researchers and their families, again, because they don't like the outcome of their research. It doesn't get worse than that. It's really a bad situation here.
Yeah, I sensed what you were saying, which was desperation and the why shouldn't we just try everything? And so I passed along your information, some additional information, saying HBOT does nothing, and they still consequently did it. So
yeah,
I was like, I did my part. You know, what can you do?
Who's next? Yeah, go ahead. It's our dear, close, longtime personal friend, Heather.
Hi, I'm Heather Bradley. I'm the creative director for an alternative to traditional teen girl media called Girl.com. It's GURL.com. I'm just wondering, we have about 500,000 girls come to the site every month, and I'm very interested in bringing skepticism and science education to teen girls, and I'm wondering if you have any suggestions to reach teenagers in this way.
I think that's in your sweet spot.
That's
Rebecca.
Kind of in my sweet spot,
yeah.
Isn't it? I think it's so important to hit them at that age. And I sometimes worry that we are sometimes so focused on the adults, and including on Skeptic, we tend to target adults, that there's a big group of girls out there who could really use a website, role models. That's the main thing. I think they need to see more women stepping forward and being vocal and being very visible in skepticism and in science. I think there are a lot of really great recent, I know L'Oreal does Women in Science Awards. I feel like I'm very optimistic about the way that we're starting to look at women in positions in science and in academics, and viewing them as role models and giving those to girls as better role models. I think it's just, you know, it's one of those baby steps sort of things where, you know, you do what you can. I think it sounds like you've got a great idea there. I'd love to, I haven't seen that yet. Why have you not sent me a link to that?
I will. Maybe we'll feature you.
We can definitely do a link exchange. I'd love to explore more ways to reach that group of girls because, yeah, they're definitely key.
She could use Lindsay Lohan as a spokesperson. That would work out pretty good.
Well, yeah, you know, it's funny because we've still got, you know, the Lindsay Lohans and the Paris Hiltons. But then you also see things like Kristen Dunst.
Yeah, Carl Sagan's book. Yeah.
She was snapped on the beach reading Carl Sagan. And, yeah, and that was kind of awesome that was huge news. I saw that everywhere.
Donica from The Wonder Years and her...
Yeah, Donica. Oh, my God, Donica is amazing. Winnie from The Wonder Years, who we all love. The hair, yes. Kiss Kevin Arnold. She wrote a book about teaching kids math, about teaching girls math and getting them interested in it. You should check that out. It just came out. Yeah, I'm really excited about things like this. I really feel like we're paying attention to the smart girls more, which is key.
And I think also if we could get James Randi on the cover of Teen Beat magazine,
yeah,
then we really have made some.
Well,
advice.
I heard that he posed in a beefcake calendar this year.
Yeah, I heard.
So.
Yeah, I just want to add a couple of things to that. Just to add the research angle, the research actually really shows that having a positive role model for a young girl is the most dominant thing that determines whether or not they're going to choose a career in science or be interested in academia. So the role model is absolutely key, you know, better than any other individual, you know, predictive factor. And also, and Steve noticed this, Steve Mirsky, who has been to our local skeptical events, when he walked in, he commented to me, wow, this is a young crowd. You know, this is different than the traditional skeptical crowd. If you go to any skeptical meeting, it's, you know, about 30 years older than the average age probably of our audience, which is great. I mean, to us, this means that we're accomplishing what we wanted to do, which was to really target a younger audience. There's also a much more even mix of men to women in this audience than I've ever seen at any of the traditional skeptical meetings. So I think that, you know, that podcasting in general has, I think, targeted a younger and more even gender mix audience for skepticism. And I think we try to style our show in such a way that it also does that. And I think the proof of the pudding is in the tasting, right? I think the audience says that we're hitting our target demographic.
I think it's kind of like a snowball too. Yeah. I mean, you know, right now, you know, when I first got involved in the whole skeptical community in 2004, I guess. And when I would go online and onto the James Randi's forums, and it was like, oh my God, a girl. What do we do? She's online. But now I look around that same exact forum, and it's lousy with chicks. They're everywhere. And, you know, and they're not afraid anymore to come out. They're not afraid that they're going to be like, oh, the chick in the room that's just going to get, you know, the bad pickup lines and whatnot.
It's all you, Rebecca. It's all you.
Those still happen.
I'll take it. I'll take them for the team. It's all right.
Marriage proposals.
The marriage proposals.
Yeah, but our listeners wouldn't stoop that low.
No, never. they're all tongue in cheek. But it's true that, you know, the women are diving into the conversation, which is important. Skepticism is inherently in your face. I mean, it's all about questioning the norm. And for a long time, we taught women to not do that. Just shut up. Do the dishes.
Be nice. And,
right, be nice. And skepticism is not about being nice. There are ways to be a nice skeptic, and I encourage everyone to do it. But at its heart, it's basically about telling people, well, no, what you believe is not quite true. This is science. This is pseudoscience. And that takes figurative balls. So I don't know. Maybe it takes ovaries too. But I think that the more women who show up and become visible, the more are going to continue to become visible. And what I'd ultimately like to see is the next time I catch a plane, I want to go to the newsstand and I want to see a Cosmo that I could actually read without wanting to vomit. I want to see, you know.
Good luck with that.
Yeah. it's something with that's targeted to women. It can be fun. It can be about fashion. It can be about, you know, shampoo. I don't care. But don't tell me that, you know, I'm a Libra, so this is the kind of shampoo I should have, and this is the kind of boy I should be dating. Give me a break. You know, they're insulting, and they don't have to be. You can have popular magazines, you can have popular shows that don't insult your intelligence.
Well, Rebecca, you're skeptical about astrology because that's typical of Libra.
A little bit, yeah. I see what you did there. That was good.
Is there any way, I have a question, is there any way, and this is a very kind of subversive thing, and I don't know if there's certainly no easy answer, is there any way of taking the current Hollywood fascination with being green and twisting that around to being skeptical, that they're getting their feet wet with science, but they don't quite know what the hell they're doing. Is there any way of using this to our advantage so we can take over the universe?
We need a color. We need to figure out what's the color of skepticism.
Yeah, the green movement, it definitely brings a skeptical element with it. The global warming debate is a very hot topic for us on the show, to the point where we almost don't even want to talk about it anymore because we get tons of emails about it. But that is bringing up a lot of discussion, and we're getting emails from like 13-year-olds that are asking us to do fact checking, or where are your facts from the last show I listened to? And I'm shocked that we have 13-year-olds that listen to us, mm-hmm. which I think is awesome, but it's pretty cool.
That's totally the appropriate
awesome.
Word to use, I think.
But when I was 13,
it's radical.
I think my mom was still picking my shirts out for me. Like, I was not thinking about issues like that today's 13-year-olds are thinking
Jay,
about.
Jay, when you were 30, your mom was still picking shirts out.
It's so easy, though.
I want to see what she picked out this morning.
No, his wife picks out his shirts.
Yeah, oh, that's right. He's married now. There she is.
I sometimes call her mom by accident. But
sick. We don't want to hear about that. Anyway.
I think we need somebody that's in the position like Al Gore to start talking about logical thinking. You know, I think the word skepticism has a predetermined concept about it, like it's a negative thing, like atheist. They kind of, you know, float in the same sphere.
Got baggage.
Yeah, I think we just need to have someone like Al Gore, who's in a position where they're a huge proponent of green, and start talking about logical thinking. And
you know, that is part of his
most recent book is a discussion of the importance of rational thought in general, not just the specifics.
Well, Steve, you know, as somebody who's in the media, I think a lot of it is capturing something that's out there. It's a hot topic, so to speak, combined with really good packaging. So how do you feel about using Scientific American? Do you ever feel like you're using that as a mouthpiece for getting skepticism out there? And
absolutely. I say to people, we are the voice of the reality-based community. I had a meeting a couple months ago with a bunch of judges who are interested in putting together some science background material for judges and lawyers, because that's an increasingly important area for people in the legal process to be aware of. One of them said, now, we don't want to be taking sides in these discussions. We just want to have the background to prepare ourselves for the arguments that are going to be presented to us. And I said, you're starting off from a fallacious viewpoint, because merely having a scientific attitude is going to require you to be on one side when you go into some of these trials that are going to come before you.
That's what scientists do.
Right.
They take sides and they argue them and defend them. And the whole point is doing experiments and stuff to know what side to take.
I mean, Judge Jones, who wrote this amazingly brilliant decision in the Dover case, the Kitzmiller trial, and it's available free online. I urge you to read the entire decision if you haven't, because it's a beautiful piece of science writing, and you will become incredibly well educated on the whole, on basic evolutionary theory and what's wrong with what they're trying to foist upon kids in schools. But Judge Jones, he understood that he had to take a side. The people came into that courtroom. One side was rational, and the other side was trying to portray an irrational attitude as being rational. And it's impossible to keep an open mind in that conversation, because you don't have anything. You lose your foundation to be a judge if you are going to grant both sides an equivalent basis in reality in those conversations.
The media, the journalists fall into that trap too.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
The mainstream journalists in this country should be ashamed of themselves.
Absolutely.
I mean, I'm proud to work at Scientific American, where we don't put up with that crap.
It goes in other fields too. As a performer, I currently have a project that I'm working on, which is a seance show. And it's a skeptical seance show. It's called The Charlatan Seance, which is redundant, of course. But we're going to be doing it down in Red Bank, New Jersey, plug, in October. And one of my big consultants on it is Teller. And we've talked about this quite a bit. And I get email from people who do psychic entertainment. And they say, well, you know, we've read about your show, and we're just afraid that you're not going to present the other side. And you're going to put that in there, right? And I go, no, and they're appalled. And I said, well, that leads to bad art. Trying to play every side, you have to have a point of view if it's going to be art. So this is just another area that you have to make a stand. So.
Jeez, if you're not going to present the other side, where did this ghost come from?
Right. It's covert puppetry that we're doing, okay? You turn out the lights, everyone holds their hands, and we scare the shellac out of them, okay? That's what it's all...
I've been brainwashed to believe that it's the other side.
My point of the thing is that spiritualism has always been fake, it always will be fake, and this show will be no different.
Cool. So. It blows my mind that they said that to you when, if you watch TV today, you know, shows that Steve has been on, where... they're crying about representing their side, but typically they're talking about ghosts for, you know, 50 minutes and 2 minutes of the skeptical idiot, you know, in the lab coat.
Did you just call punk. Steve a skeptical idiot?
No, but that's how we're represented.
It's token, always, James. We're called tokens.
Yeah.
Well, but
I get to say, bat.
But
on our first episode, we said sciences were dumbfounded. What was that? Remember, we would say, like, they always show the lab-coated scientists, and they're baffled. Scientists are baffled.
They're always baffled.
And they give us 30 seconds,
And they're crying to you that they want, you know.
Well, because, you know, it's sexier to believe in crap.
Yeah.
It's easier and it's more fun. It's the, you know, sitting around telling ghost stories.
It's easier,
more fun.
But it's not more fun.
No.
Well, it's not sexier anymore.
It's, yeah, you're right. Yeah. Well,
our stories ultimately are better stories. They're more nuanced, they're more complex, they're more beautiful.
Yep. I think we need to know how to tell them, though.
Let me take that back and say they're not more fun. It's cheap.
Yeah. It's
just
it's
cheap and cheap and easy, and I think that's the appeal of it.
Mm.
Yeah. We got another question.
Hi, I'm Trevor Perry. I'm a computer weenie and a motivational speaker, and I've been curious since I was 13. But I've also been a skeptic for a very, very long time, and I study the human condition a lot just by observing people, which has been interesting today, of course. One of the things I find in my motivational speaking is that I get in your face, and when I talk to people and I tell them something that's the truth that they haven't thought about, they might go away and they may be pissed at me, but I stir emotions and I get in their face. And that's pretty easy for a motivational speaker. For a skeptic, it's real difficult because I get in people's face all the time. One of my sessions is called Get Over It, and it's all about all of the lies, starting with the lies of, you know, an airbag being, you know, inflated for a very long time and how people believe that kind of thing. It's lazy because it's real easy to believe. There's something in the human condition that belief or something that they still can't, no matter how much in your face I am, which is sort of really hard to do, what is it that we can do, that one-on-one thing? I know you talked about individual girls, and I know you talked about getting out there and having, you know, Al Gore be the spokesperson for purple or whatever our color is. But the concept is, how do we get to these people? Is it always just in your face, or is there a way that we can let them down easy? And
I think it's baby steps. I learned this from Bob and Steve because I'm a very in-your-face type of person. I used to go to the throat. I used to love it. I didn't even know that I was deliberately antagonizing people with my skepticism because I felt like I knew what was right. You know, and then Steve and Bob, after years of them, we're going back 10 years now, right, 10, 15 years, I learned, my personal journey was, I learned that you just have to ping them. You know, put a little thing in their ear as often as you can without being aggressive about it. And I've done this, and I notice over time, you will get some people to start to lean more in a skeptical direction.
And it won't be immediate either, because a lot of skeptics think that, wow, I'm not getting the feedback that I'm expecting. Wasn't that a great argument I just gave you? Didn't I just blow your whole theory away? And you're not going to see that. Pride is so powerful that people won't. But I if you do a good job, and if a lot of times what I see is later on, you might see some of the skepticism creeping into their interaction with you, and you can't expect it fast. And one thing we learned early on was that the true believers, there's nothing you could do. How many people were a diehard true believer for years, and to expect that they're going to make a change, you really shouldn't expect it.
Yeah, Michael Shermer is like
happen.
The only real public one.
It's too rare. We focus on the fence sitters and to give the people that are like-minded the better tools, the skeptical tools. So those are the people we target. Some people are just, they're not going to change. I don't care. You can't expect it.
Yeah, the psychological literature is really disheartening because it shows how our brains work. And they work in every way that they shouldn't, you know, in order to be a good skeptic. So, I mean, skepticism is a very high energy state. And when we talk about intellectual laziness, that's another way to look at that, is that that's the lowest energy state, right, to be in just thought-wise. And our brains are just, that's the way they function. There was just a recent study out this week, I think I have this slated to talk about on our next show, but we could talk about it now, is that there's a study that shows that when people are given misinformation, and then the misinformation is later corrected, even after it's corrected, they still believe the initial misinformation. Mm-hmm. So if you have a false news report and then it's all cleared up later, you know, in the post-discussion, it doesn't matter. People remember, believe, and continue to believe after correction the initial misinformation that they were given. And that's just one example of all the ways in which our brain doesn't really work very well in the complex, you know, civilization that we live in right now. So there's no substitute for the hard work of learning about logic, learning how to think, learning the value of evidence and why anecdotes are misleading, about all the psychological things. You know, there is, when you really think about it, there's a vast repertoire of intellectual tools that we draw upon in order to maintain our skepticism. It really takes a lot of work. And you just can't hand that to somebody wholesale. You can't do it. They're buried under this sea of psychology and evolution and misinformation, and it takes a long time to dig them out of it, and you could only do it if they want it. Or if they're willing. The best you could do, as Bob and Jay said, is plant a seed and see what happens. It'll grow or it won't grow. And that's a very apt metaphor. And we've all had that experience where you say something to somebody, they're never, almost never going to say, yeah, you're right, I was totally wrong, you corrected my misinformation or my illogic. It never happens. They'll fight you, and then when you talk to them about the issue 3 months later, they'll echo your opinion back to you as if it were their own. Psychologically, that's actually what you have to do. You have to make people think it was their idea. That's the only way people believe things, if you make them think it was their own idea. It's kind of like trickery. I know mentalists do that a lot. One mentalist trick is to make you think you came up with something when in fact it was what the mentalist wanted you to come up with to begin with. And you know, if you want to change somebody's mind or change their opinion about things, psychologically, that's what works. You have to give it time for them to convince themselves that it was their own idea.
So when you do your motivational speaking, what's the main theme, like better your life? Because what I was thinking about from your question, instead of attacking, say, people's religion, which on the whole is not a good idea, I don't know what you're doing, but you could do exercises in logical thinking. You know, maybe walk them through an exercise, and hopefully that could be maybe one of the vehicles you use to teach them. You know, when you're doing problem solving, like go through this and give them a scenario that's kind of generic that maybe everyone could relate to but won't take a personal attack from. What are you teaching people?
My motivational is really sort of more like a keynote rather than an educational experience. It's more along the lines of balance your work and your life. Put more life in your work. It's balance, mm-hmm. And it's trying to find a place for you, and you know, give you a family life, etc. Rather than be stuck in work. It's usually to computer weenies. I don't really get in people's face for that. It's really when I do my get over it one, that's really just a look, here's a bunch of crap that you've been told. Ha ha, you know, and I try and make it as motivating and as silly as I possibly can so that people walk away and go, I knew that already, or I didn't believe it before, maybe I do now, or if I want to believe it, keep believing it, I will. It's really the one-on-one thing that more concerns me, because I don't really challenge people's religion except one-on-one.
When it comes to friends, I find, you know, I have some friends that believe really stupid stuff. The other day I found out, well, actually a few weeks ago I found out that a coworker actually really does think that there's something to that astrology thing. And he said, oh, no, not the stuff in the paper, but...
the real stuff.
The real stuff.
Yeah. Astrology.
Science. There's an ology at the end, so...
We have a capital A.
And so all I do is, you know, every time astrology comes up, I just make a joke about it. And, I mean, every time it comes up, we goof around about it. I'll read him his little horoscope from the paper. I'll read him the wrong one and ask if was that right. Oh, yeah, that was it exactly. See, even the paper one is good sometimes. I'm like, oh, wait, I'm sorry, did you say Aries? you know, and it's a lighthearted approach that doesn't make him feel, I'm not telling him he's an idiot, but I'm laughing at him and telling him he's an idiot. But it's okay, because that's our relationship. We laugh at each other sometimes. Friends do that. You know, they goof off, they make fun of each other. So I just sort of inject it into that whole relationship.
Humor is the sugarcoat.
And eventually, eventually it kind of dawns on him, you know, that, okay, yeah, it's goofy.
Ironically, you know, I think the battle's always going to be an uphill battle, because I think we may have been evolutionarily selected for to not accept evolution. And that means
sneaky.
You're out there on a daily basis struggling. I mean, I know personally, I think in some ways being a skeptic is like being an alcoholic. It's one day at a time, because
it's nearly
I believe in my bones that what I do affects whether the Yankees win or not. And I have to intellectually override that on a daily basis. No, if I don't watch the game tonight, it won't affect the outcome. It's okay to go out to dinner.
Can we edit all of this out? So
but by the same token, I know that it's not true. And it's like, who was it, Niels Bohr and the horseshoe? Mm-hmm. You know, you all know the story. If it's not Niels Bohr, it's some famous physicist who had a horseshoe hanging in his office, and somebody walked in said, "I'm surprised you believe in stuff like this." He says, "I don't believe in it, but I understand it works whether you believe in it or not."
Very good. And I guess the thing is that since I do this kind of speaking, then I'm subject to a lot of people coming up afterwards, like you guys are, and hammering me one-on-one about that. And that's where I find that, you know, I don't know these people. They're not necessarily friends, and humor doesn't necessarily work because my Australian sense of humor pisses most people off in America.
Yeah. But then why do you care? You say whatever you want, and you'll never see me again.
I care because I'm human, and I want people to want me and want people to like me. It's another human condition.
Get over it.
Yeah, thank you. So I want to know where the 12-step program is for skeptics, if you let me know.
First, become less human. Way to go, Steve.
That's just the kind of image we need to put out. And if I were you, I would tell your friend that God wants her to believe in evolution.
And can I say, you know, thank you for coming all the way from Australia for this?
Yeah.
Yes, thank you.
It's a long way.
All right, who's next?
Okay, hi. I know that from personal experience, I was always somebody who assumed that science wasn't for me, that I was somebody who just wasn't that type of person. I was into language, I was into music, I was into that crap. And it's good stuff. I'm still into it. But what I found, I found a lot of influence. I was heavily influenced by reading Carl Sagan. I basically stole my life philosophy from him. And one of the most important things I found in his work is this argument for teaching critical thinking in schools and teaching it at a young age. And I was wondering, what do you think are the steps that we could take towards integrating that into an educational system, integrating that kind of critical thinking and rationality into our schools?
First thing we have to do is fire that new Texas school board chairman.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Who actually said that he wants to reduce the amount of critical thinking as a secondary skill in these curriculum and go back to teaching facts. Not how to think. You've got to teach the facts, and you have critical thinking, that's secondary. So there's that attitude in the educational system. That's certainly not representative of everybody. That's one end of it that is trying to infiltrate school boards and control at a local level. You know, really subvert the teaching of our children because of religious and other social ideology, and actually remove the teaching of critical thinking. You know, that's exactly what's happening in China, for example. There was just a recent paper. You know, we talked about this. It was kind of a controversial episode. We talked about just the culture in China, but there's been a lot even since then about the fact that the government actually discourages critical thinking so that they could mind control the population.
Well, that was something that interested me also in Carl Sagan's work. He wrote that in the Soviet Union, after the Soviet Union collapsed, there's been this uprising of belief in astrology and belief in all this spirituality. And, you know, you go to a Russian news page and you'll find online and you'll find a lot of misinformation and a lot of pseudoscience right on the front page. And that shows me that this is not something that is just limited to where we are. This is something that should be taught universally.
Well, luckily, I think that it's definitely on the radar of a lot of skeptics. I see a huge group of skeptical teachers who are active in the skeptical community who are teaming together to come up with lesson plans for their kids, and this is on every level. I see it in grade school, in junior high, high school, and it's not just the science teachers. You can, if you teach literature, you can find interesting texts to read. It's all about, because it is about how to think, and you can work the skeptic and the scientific sort of way of thinking into any subject matter. So I think a huge part of it is those teachers banding together, strengthening that, and then on another level, it's people like the people here today, even if you're not a teacher, it's paying attention to what's going on. What's going on with your local schools? Do you know? Do you know who's on your school board?
Yeah, absolutely. Go to the school board meetings. Run for the school board. You don't have to have kids to run for the school board. Go to the website of the National Center for Science Education, run by Eugenie Scott, and you will find a listing of all the hot spots in the country at any time, and they're in every state where a local school board is trying to inflict some nonsense on the children by ruining the curriculum. Watch what's in the textbooks. And again, read the Kitzmiller decision by Judge Jones, because you'll see what the strategies were that these people tried to bring in their version of reality into the schools.
Yeah, I have read it. I love it. It's amazing.
Just to echo that, my own personal experiences, I obviously went through high school, 4 years of college as well. Never had a critical thinking course, was never offered a critical thinking course, didn't know about critical thinking, ironically, until after I got out of college, read Carl Sagan, was introduced to the skeptical literature. I became self-aware myself. Schooling did not help me at all. I have a 4-year-old daughter at home. I promise that I'm going to pay very close attention to her curriculum as she goes through her school to make sure that she gets the fundamental tools she does need from the education system, critical thinking amongst them. So definitely individuals like us paying attention to what's going on in our local systems is extremely important and does definitely make a difference.
And can we please, please vote for a president that believes in evolution? Let's just start with the evolution thing.
Not believes in evolution, accepts evolution.
Yeah.
It's not a question of belief.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, it's a scientific consensus.
But the good news is 7 out of the 10 Republican candidates did not deny their acceptance of evolution. When you actually get into it with them, they don't really know what they're talking about either. But yeah.
That was a great question, because when they raised their hands, they went, okay, you're out. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Brownback, Huckabee, and Tancredo.
Right. Thank you.
And then Brownback, if you haven't read Brownback's brilliant op-ed piece in the New York Times, I mean brilliant in terms of comedy, it is one of the most hilarious pieces of... It's not writing. What is it? It's
rambling?
It's rationalization. It's basically
apology.
I accept the findings of science, except when I don't like them.
Yeah.
That's the basic summation of that piece.
I think next time, behind the podiums, they should have trap doors. Everyone that says it, bam, they disappear. That's
Austin
okay,
Powell.
Now we can continue.
Giuliani actually decided not to answer the religion question. He said, he basically said, what does it have to do with this? It's not.
Well, he asked the evolution question, but not what about his faith. He said, none of your business, basically, which is a good answer.
Which is good. Keep it out. Right? Imagine that. Separation of church and state.
Mm. Who would have thunk it? Getting back to turn it a little bit towards how to teach critical thinking, I think the biggest thing is, teaching people to ask, well, how do we know? And not like, here's some facts from authority. I have an 8-year-old daughter and extremely curious, extremely bright. Whenever she asks me a question about the world, my first response is always, well, gee, how could we know? How could we know what color dinosaurs were or whatever her question is? Let's think about that. And then we try to figure it out together to try to lead what kind of evidence or logic could lead us to an answer, rather than just saying, whatever, they were brown, shut up, or whatever. Here's the answer. And she has responded to that tremendously, and she actually loves it when authority figures are wrong. Daddy said something and that wasn't right, and Mommy said something else. She loves it. And I think that's, a healthy disrespect for authority is like a good place to start.
Which so
is
how do we know?
Kind of an ironic.
How do we know what color they were?
We don't, Jay.
Somebody's got to know.
Didn't you see that movie? Jurassic Park? Kind of green.
We have evidence.
Ask Steve Spielberg. He knows.
And speaking of science, I think we should segue into our next little segment here, which is the science or fiction.
And now it's time to play Science or Fiction!
Thank you, Cheryl. All right. This is a very popular segment of our show. Every week, I come up with 3 science news items or facts, and then I challenge my panel of skeptics and all of you to tell me which one is the fake. So 2 of these are real, 1 is fake. And this time, you guys are going to actually be put on the spot and asked for your opinion. So be...
We get the ask.
So you have to actually pay attention to the items. All right. Is everybody ready? Number 1.
No,
and Bob, I looked at your list.
This is not fair. Jay has a computer.
Go and check what you're saying. Go ahead.
Bob, I looked at your list. None of your items are on.
Look at my list.
Right. Number 1. Scientists have used X-rays to help determine why insects are so small. Item number 2. researchers have broken the wavelength barrier and worked out a method for nanoscale light microscopy with resolution finer than the wavelength of light used. And number three, recent observations indicate that Mars, contrary to prior belief, has a significant magnetic field. Those are the three items.
What was the first one again?
The first one, scientists have used X-rays to help determine why insects are as small as they are.
So let me come up there. Who's got an opinion on this? Oh, you've got an opinion.
I don't know about those first two. The Mars thing, being an astronomer, I might have heard about it. That's the classic argument, right? I would have heard about this
one.
Yeah,
we always say that.
And I just spent a week with a bunch of astronomers, about 200 of them. So that probably would have come up as a topic of conversation. So I'm going to have to say that one's the fiction, although I really don't like that second one about observing something finer than the wavelength of the light you're observing with.
And, you can't argue with 200 astronomers, though, can you?
Yeah, so there's my argument.
Right. I do pull these right off of the Newswire, like, hours ago. That's why Bob's list doesn't have it on it.
Steve, you might want to point out that if you actually specifically read the article, please don't say that you read it, because then that kind of makes it easier for everybody else if you actually read it.
You should run up and whisper it in my ear, though, if you did.
Right. So who's got an opinion up here? Here we go.
I've worked in semiconductors, and you can create structures with photolithography that are smaller than the wavelength of light using interference. So I think I can totally buy that one. And the Mars one doesn't feel right.
It's a good clue.
Yeah, I knew that.
Okay.
I knew that too.
Anyone else?
That's exactly what I was going to say.
We've been going at this so long, someone's given birth up here. That's great.
What was that first one about the bugs again?
Scientists have used X-rays to help determine why insects are small.
We don't have small insects in Brooklyn, my friend.
Oh, that's a good one. That's a good point.
Small is a relative term.
Okay. And anyone else? Anyone else?
I'm going to jump on the bandwagon with the Mars thing, because on one hand, I think if it's significant, it would have been detected before. Maybe not, but specifically also by process of elimination. The second one, half because half of what you said I don't understand, so it probably is true. But also because I recall I was this past semester doing an honors project on the evolution of the invertebrate eye, which was a blast. And I remember something about the lens having little like bumps shorter than a wavelength, which somehow helped with reflection, something. And if we could figure out that those exist, why couldn't we do whatever the heck it was you were saying? And the first one, I remember reading something about X-raying insects, and I think they commented something on the size. I don't remember exactly what it was, but I'm going to say sure. Why not with that, too? So by process of elimination, I'll go with the third one being the fiction.
It seems like we have a consensus here. Anyone else that's big on Mars that would like to defend the honor of Mars here?
Why don't we do a show of hands?
Everyone
raise their hand to the fake.
Yeah, that's good.
So for those who think that number one about insects being small, they used X-rays, think that that's the fake one, raise your hand.
Oh, there are a few.
Oh, there we go. Hmm. Number two, which is about wavelengths, and if they're so, why can't we all get along or something like that? So we got one guy that believes that's fake.
Sir, you're wrong.
And three, that he ain't heavy, he's Mars, something like that.
Magnets don't work on Mars.
Not like that.
So yeah, what about you guys?
We need those little things that they have in Who Wants to Be a Millionaire.
Yeah. Audience response systems.
Yeah.
Didn't have the budget for that.
Sorry,
right.
Maybe next one.
Let's see.
Wow.
So what,
All right.
Oh, they're pondering. Look at that.
I think Bob should start.
No. Okay. Go ahead, Bob.
Start at that end.
Steve.
No, you start.
Steve's our guest.
This is like the totally bogus episode.
If you tune into the Scientific American Weekly podcast, we do pretty much the same thing. But we do three true stories and only one false story, so you get another 33% for your
free
money spent. So I think it's the magnetic field of Mars is the fake.
Well, and I'll say it because we have the smartest audience in podcasting history, so I will definitely go with them and agree. Mars is fake. Mars is fake?
The magnetic field question about Mars
is fake.
Could you
repeat the one about the insects again?
Jay does this every show, by the way, but you don't know it because I always edit it out.
X-rays have shown why insects are so small.
Thank you, Steve.
I've heard it so many times, I know it.
I usually ask questions, too. When you say shows why they're so small...
Yes.
Steve, was that a CAT scan or a PET scan?
It's a bug scan. He's the bug scanner, and it tells them why they're as small as they are.
Did they wear little tiny lead aprons?
let's rephrase it.
I feel
it.
Lame going with the Mars thing, but what the hell, you know? Mars.
Yeah, see, I almost want to go with the second one, just so that guy isn't alone.
Oh, that's so sweet.
I know. But I'm going to go with Mars because I want to win.
Bob.
Okay.
Here comes the Bob Long analysis.
For Bob, just so you know, this is like Final Jeopardy, and the world is riding on it every week. Every week. This takes like half an hour.
It usually starts with Steve. Steve edits down.
He always knows where to cut. It's right where I say, for God's sake, Bob, just say it.
The second one, the wavelength of light, I'm just going to go with that one. The first one, I'm not sure. I'm going to actually buy into that one, but I'm not sure how the X-rays could actually help determine why bugs are so small.
There's the rub.
Yeah. Well, don't they use X-rays with some sort of... I know that they can use X-rays to determine the structure of... I don't know, atomic structure. I could think maybe that might come into play somehow. I'm not sure. But the third one... The Mars magnetic field, I mean, that's pretty, I thought that was pretty fairly well established. Isn't the, you know, the mantle and core inert in Mars, and that's pretty much what causes the magnetic field, and that's one of the dangers of being on Mars, is the radiation that hits you. So I'm going to go with that one and just agree with everybody else.
Wait, I thought you were going number two. At the beginning you said number two.
Bob always says I'm going with it, meaning he buys into it.
Oh, yeah.
It's real.
I mean,
to confuse us, I have to edit that, too.
Three.
This is also always how it goes.
Three.
Four.
Bob, which one? Which one did you pick?
Mars. I said I'm agreeing with everybody else.
All right. So there does seem to be a consensus. We'll take them in order. So the first one is scientists have used X-rays to help determine why insects are small. Yeah, Bob, they also use X-rays to take X-rays. Which is what they did.
Yeah.
So what they found is that, and part of this was known for a long time. Insects are as small as they are, by which I mean I think Steve was looking for the clarification why they aren't bigger. Why aren't insects bigger than they currently are?
Oxygen.
Because of oxygen. That's right. And this takes us one step further. And what they found was that by using the X-rays, they could image the little tubules, the little conduits through which insects get oxygen to their tissue, and that there's a choke point where the limbs come off of the insect. And this is actually, they could be a little bit bigger than they are if it weren't for the fact that they had this choke point at where the legs come off or whatever. So that sets another even smaller limit on insect size. This is also, by the way, why when you see dinosaur movies, there's these huge dragonflies that are this big. It's because the oxygen content in the atmosphere was a few points higher back then, like 24.
That's why those are in the movies?
Yes.
Exactly.
Okay. You saw the movie Caveman when they squashed the bug on his face and it
That's
covered
all
his
real.
Skin.
Steve, what color were those bugs?
Black and white. They're old movies.
Right. So that one is that one. Of course, is science. We'll take the second one. But no.
Hey, Steve.
Yes.
Speaking of none of that, can we plug the New York Skeptics?
That's right. Because you know why? It's right here.
Yeah.
I was asked to do this and I forgot.
Yeah. You don't have to do it now. Right in the middle of the game. I know we're all on the edge of our seat.
Why interrupt the segment?
Good timing. I'll pause and keep you on
the edge
of your seat.
I was just thinking about the bugs.
We want to announce the New York City Skeptics, www.nycskeptics.org. Who are they? Are any in the room right here? Raise your hands.
There you go. Hey.
Thanks for coming. So if you live in New York and you're looking for a skeptical movement, a skeptical organization, there they are.
Thank you.
The second one. Now Perry wasn't here, so I could use that one with nano in the title, because Perry's rule is if it has nano in the title, it's real. So he just votes. He'll buy that one. And Bob.
That's called Perry's law.
Perry's law. And Bob, of course, is the nano freak, so he always agonizes over the nano one. Is that in there because Steve just trying to get me? This one is really interesting because a couple of people hit upon it. What's interesting about this is resolution smaller than the wavelength of light being used. That is a traditional limit.
Isn't it half the wavelength?
What's that?
Think smaller than half the
right, wavelength. Yes. But this is smaller than the traditional limit. And this is light microscopy. That right. I specifically said light microscopy. So that limit of the ultimately set by the wavelength is there. But what these scientists did was that they used these molecules that are fluorescent, and they figured out a way to like turn on and off the fluorescence at will, and then they will tag a structure, like it could even be a living cell, which is why it's interesting that it's light microscopy, because you can image living things or intact things, as opposed to, say, electron microscopy, where it has to be dead and freeze fractured in order to image it. And what they do is they essentially build a picture of the structure pixel by pixel by turning on these fluorescent molecules, which then produces a pixel. Then they turn that off and they turn on one next to it. And they just keep doing it over and over and over again until pixel by pixel they build an image with finer details in the wavelength of light that's being used to image the fluorescent molecules. So that's what they did. And that's actually quite a clever way to do that.
So what you're saying is that was science.
That was science. Okay. That one was science.
So we all win.
Which means, yes, that the magnetic field of Mars is indeed fiction. However, what the article was really about, actually Mars does have a lot of magnetic, yeah, thanks astronomer guy.
Yeah, right.
Doing it for
yeah.
everybody. Mars does have magnetic rocks, and because Mars used to have a magnetic field. Even though it hasn't had a magnetic field for a long time, I think more than a billion years or so, there are still rocks on Mars which retain the remnant of Mars's old magnetic field. And some kinds of rocks retain this old remnant and some don't. And what the new research is showing is that there are rocks on Earth that also have a remnant of what the magnetic field of the Earth used to be a billion years ago. They haven't aligned with the current magnetic field, and they're investigating to figure out why is it that some rocks will maintain this old remnant and some don't. And it has to do with the microscopic structure of the rocks, and that which is too much detail for me to get into because I don't understand it, about why exactly those rocks do it. But so what they were saying was that Mars did have a magnetic field. Some of those rocks will still give us information about that magnetic field because of certain kinds of rocks that we can study on the Earth will contain the remnant of that magnetic field. But the only way to really do that is to go to Mars and actually pick up the rocks and examine them, rocks that we get from Mars. So that was the piece that inspired the magnetic field one, which was a little bit easy, but you guys did a great job. Thanks.
Well done.
Thank you all.
Well, there you go. Is there anything we should say in summation here? Or?
That's right. Dave, thanks, everyone, for coming. Thanks for all the
This is
panelists.
A good time.
Steve, Todd, we really greatly appreciate it. We are going out after this. And everyone is welcome.
Well, there you go. And everyone's going to buy a drink for the guy that thought the...
Everybody owes that guy a drink.
Anyway, thank you all for coming and being part of this. And we'll see you all online. Be good, and if you can't be good, be careful. Thank you.
Thank you.
Little did they know of the fatal flaw.